Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, everybody loves our dollars. The author of a new book about money laundering tells me why the current attempt to stop it are a pure waste of time. We hear about the strange economics of the breakaway country of Somaliland, plus this. Look at the economics of nighttime working. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, the oil price has been swinging wildly, and I thought for my explainer this week I would talk through the differences between Brent crude and WTI, because you can hear them sometimes interchangeably mentioned, but there are differences and significant ones between them. Brent crude oil originates from the North Sea and it serves as the benchmark for European, African and Middle Eastern markets. And OPEC uses Brent crude as the pricing benchmark as well, so that's what influences global oil prices. Now, if you were in the US, you'd hear something different. That's when you'd hear about WTI, which is the West Texas Intermediate, and that's the benchmark for the US oil market. And of course, that's sourced from American oil fields. So when we talk about the oil price, it's likely to be Brent crude if you're here listening to us in Ireland. But if you're in the US, you might hear something different and wonder why. And well, Taking Stock listeners, now you know the difference. Now, Somaliland declared itself independent from Somalia in 1991, 35 years ago. It has 6.2 million people in its population, but my next guest has been writing in the Financial Times this week about how it is in diplomatic limbo and has unrequited promise. However, last December, Israel was the first country in the world to recognise it as an independent state, and with recent geopolitical developments, Somaliland's trajectory may be changing. Joining me now is William Wallace, who is the East and Central Africa correspondent of the Financial Times based in Nairobi. William, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. And can you first of all walk us through what is life like on the ground for people in Somaliland at the moment?
It's really pretty tough. If you don't have a passport from another country, you can't essentially travel anywhere else in the world. It's very, very difficult to do business with, even in the region. Sometimes you have to do it in cash. Because Somaliland is not recognized as an independent nation diplomatically, it makes all sorts of things incredibly difficult. So this has really stunted its development. However, despite that, it's a very optimistic place and really a refreshingly open place as well. So you've got grinding poverty on the one hand, but you've got real hope and optimism, partly because Somalilanders are expecting that many more nations, rightly or wrongly expecting, I should say, will join Israel in recognizing them in the years to come.
So let me just unpack a couple of the points that you made there. First of all, you referred to doing business in cash. Does it have its own currency?
Yes, but a lot of the business it does in cash has to be in dollars because its currency isn't transferable across borders. In fact, one of the remarkable things about the place is that it was one of the very first countries in the world to essentially go almost entirely mobile money. And that was because of the difficulties they were facing, partly in transferring things like remittances from abroad. So there's a really developed cashless economy in Somaliland.
And I'm guessing if they could go to mobile money, there must be a telecoms infrastructure. It sounds like the ability to engage with Wi-Fi or that type of thing then must be in place as well.
Yes, that's all pretty standard. Most of the problems that the country has occur as soon as you want to get anything over the border.
Oh, okay. That's the difference. Now, but you also mentioned about grinding poverty, and that's a really stark term. I read in your piece that the GDP of the country, am I even saying the right term there with country, but the state, is $4.28 billion. And then I cross-referenced that with something you mentioned earlier in the piece about the 6.2 million people. So the population is the equivalent of that to Singapore, but the GDP of Singapore is 137 times that of Somaliland when I worked out the numbers in that regard. So when you say grinding poverty, what is lifestyle like in terms of buying things?
It does vary like everywhere. In Hargeisa, the capital, where a significant proportion of the population live, is a bustling capital. There are restaurants, there aren't bars because there's no alcohol permitted in Somaliland, but there are cafes. However, the large majority of the population depends on essentially subsistence farming or livestock production. And that shows up in the nation's export figures, which are, I think, 70% dependent on livestock exports to the Gulf. So it gives you an idea. It's an originally pastoralist country and nomadic people. So they're still very dependent on goats, camels, cattle, less cattle.
I spent some time last year in Nigeria. I was out there for a week. And as you're talking, that's what I'm comparing it against to was some of the landscapes that I saw. And I was outside of Lagos as well in some parts that were quite rural. So I'm trying to imagine here what the picture would be like. But some of the things you mentioned in your piece this week are in such contrast to life as we would know it. Like you said, there is no bank guarantee, no insurance. The country has no external debt. And like you referenced earlier, people can't have a passport that's recognised at international borders since the country itself doesn't exist constitutionally. So in terms of how transactions happen and the trust underpinning them, how is business done then?
That's a really interesting question, because in the early days, particularly post 9/11, when financial transactions were globally put under so much more scrutiny with anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist financing laws, a lot of the transfers that were going on, at least cross-border at that point, were in really informal networks. So you'd go, say, in London to someone from the Somaliland community and pay them some money, and somehow it would turn up in Hargeisa, perhaps in the local currency. But precisely because of those stringent anti-money laundering laws and the focus that was placed on Somalia more broadly at the time, the Somalilanders actually put together this incredibly sophisticated mobile money service, which also has a very high level of trust and due diligence involved. So In a funny way, because of the constraints they originally faced, they've got one of the most fraud-proof systems in the region.
Fraud-proof. And is that because of the constraints of needing to be within domestic borders?
That's where it came from, but it's partly also because it's a very close-knit society and very much united in this in this desire for recognition for independence from its failing neighbor Somalia, and you don't want to be struck off in any way, and being, if you fall foul of those kinds of laws, it's a real shame within the society as well, and causes you a huge amount of problems. So it's partly because of those basic things,
and within that sense of unity and that sense of common purpose, and even going back to the hope and optimism that you referred to earlier, what is the political system like? Is it a democracy, or is there a different type of social contract?
This is another one of the surprising things about the country, is that despite the fact that there was no sort of outside pressure, it is a very democratic society. In the aftermath of the war from which it emerged as a self-declared nation in the 90s, the Somaliland clans got together and basically formed their own kind of democracy. And it's actually a lot freer and fairer than most of the countries in this East African region and the Horn of Africa. Each election, it's the norm for the presidency to change hands between political parties. That's extremely rare in Africa. And it's partly, I would argue, the result of the fact that they didn't have huge amounts of foreign aid pouring in, other kinds of interest groups controlling government coffers and controlling, having influence over government. The government's actually, it's not by any means perfect, but it is responsive to the population because it's accountable to it.
I'm interested that you said it's a lot freer and fairer. And fairer I get, but freer I'm not quite sure I'm understanding exactly what you're saying there. Is that the reference back to not having those external pressures, or does freer have another implication?
Well, no, I just think that when elections come round, they're not perfect by any means, but people are free to speak their mind in Somaliland in a way that isn't the case in some other countries in this region, particularly in recent times when we've seen some pretty horrific repression, state-orchestrated repression ahead of elections.
Okay, now that makes sense. And I would like to now go to the 26th of December 2025. A big development happened, namely Israel was the first country in the world to recognise the Somaliland as an independent state. And I looked at some of the coverage on this. Reuters described Israel's recognition of the state as a decision that could reshape regional dynamics. Somalia's government feels Israel's move was an unlawful step and a deliberate attack on its sovereignty. And of course, all of this happened before the invasion of Iran. What's your take on why Israel is doing this?
I think Israel's primary motive in this is to gain some kind of a foothold on the Red Sea, which is obviously an extremely strategic part of the world for Israel. Over just across the sea from Somaliland, you've got Yemen and you've got Houthi rebels who've targeted Israel. So clearly they want eyeballs of some sort on the Houthis as well. At the moment, there's no concrete suggestion that Israel is going to have anything like a military base in Somaliland. It's come up as an idea, but there's nothing confirmed on that front yet. But clearly they want an ally in that region, and they didn't have one before, at least along the Red Sea coast. So they're aiming to get a foothold in the region, and that's obviously extremely controversial among some of the other states, both across the Red Sea and on the African side.
And why is Somalia feeling that this is a deliberate attack on its sovereignty? Because, of course, it hasn't recognised this part of the territory as independently. But what is Somalia, and indeed the other states within the Gulf, afraid of?
Well, Somalia still claims Somaliland as part of Somalia. So this recognition obviously challenges that sovereignty over Somaliland. But in effect, Somaliland has been operating as an independent state for nearly 35 years. The government in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, controls only a tiny part of the country. There are other breakaway regions, and there's also the Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab, which controls much of the country. But Somalis still harbour ambitions to reclaim Somaliland as part of a greater Somalia.
So by virtue of the fact that Israel has now given legitimacy to the independent state, do you see others following through?
This is a very thorny question, particularly at the time that it came, when Israel itself is very isolated on the international stage. In some ways, you could argue that it may have complicated Somaliland's task for finding others to follow. Because there are many nations that don't want to be boxed in alongside Israel at this point in time. And that probably is even more the case in the wake of the US-Israel war on Iran. The many Somalilanders, however, argue that they needed an ally someone to advocate for them on the international stage. Israel has a huge amount of influence, and nobody else was coming forward, and they really appreciate the help that Israel is offering. So, and Somalilanders are extremely defensive about that. It's difficult. It's come at a very, very tense moment in the wider region, but also in the Horn of Africa.
We're speaking today, and it's March 2026, William, and I'm also conscious that this happened in December 2025. If I had brought up Israel at that point, we naturally would have been talking about the Israeli-Gaza conflict at the time. So how does the Somali lander feel about that side of things, particularly given the religious nature of the population?
Again, that's a question I probed a lot when I was in Somaliland, and the answer is kind of unexpected. There is actually quite a long history of relations between Somaliland and Israel. Israel was actually one of the first states to recognize Somaliland when it gained independence from Britain in 1960, and before it joined Somalia in a union. The Israelis were also very sympathetic to Somalilanders in the 80s when many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Somalilanders were killed by the Siad Barre dictatorship. So there is a long history that goes back and empathy between the two peoples that perhaps isn't widely known about. However, when you ask about Gaza specifically, the kind of answer you get is that they're being recognized independently by Israel of any other global events, and they will take recognition from anyone who will give it to them.
Well, William, I have to say there are layers and layers to this, whether it's diplomatically or politically or financially or otherwise, and it's one to watch in the coming weeks and months. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. That is William Wallace, East and Central Africa correspondent of the Financial Times based in Nairobi.
Thank you so much, Susan.
This is Susan A's Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and after the break, we look at the business of working the night shift. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Culleton. Now, for my trivia this week. I was working with a group of female entrepreneurs somewhere in the world, and I want to give you three clues as to where I was to see if you can determine where that location was. So the river that flows through this place is the second fastest flowing river in Europe. This place also has the second highest amount of coffee shops per capita in Europe, second only to Athens in Greece. And it has, on average, two festivals a week. There's a real two theme here. So where was I? I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, hats off to the taxi drivers and retail workers and doctors and nurses who work during the night to make sure that the rest of us get to go home, have milk for our cornflakes and have a hospital bed to go to if needs be. Working at night seems to be becoming much less of a thing these days. Or is it? Well, Soumaya Keynes of the Financial Times has been looking at some of the data around the globe and who works when. First off, Soumaya, if we go right back to the introduction of the light bulb, to me, that would be the major catalyst, not necessarily just of working at night, but this sense of 24/7 industrial type of shift work per se. Where do you see the origins of this coming from?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, before we had the light bulb, obviously there was the candle, but clearly, you know, it was not really capable of emitting enough light to, you know, sustain proper factory work. I mean, it's about energy and industrialization, but I think, you know, I mean, nighttime work has existed as long as we have needed, you know, nighttime services. If you think about, say, midwives, right? You know, babies have been born in the middle of the night for a very, very long time. So, I think I'd struggle to trace the kind of the origins of nighttime work to a single kind of modern technology. I think what the data shows is that there's always, you know, some need for work to happen at nighttime. And, you know, there's just a question of how those relative needs change over time.
Well, indeed, babies do not schedule their arrival. I'm sure there is many a mother listening to us who wish that they did. But if we look at the culture of this around the world, in your piece that you wrote earlier on this month, you said by 2022-23, roughly 1 in 8 employees, and this was in the US, said they worked for at least 1 hour between 10:30 p.m. and 5:30 a.m. on a weekday. To me, the culture of working in the US would be far less boundaried, I suppose, than we might consider in Europe. What did your findings show you?
Yeah, I think your hunch there is right. Generally, Americans work, you know, they have fewer boundaries, right? They work more weekends, they work later at night. That said, it is really, really hard to compare across countries. I'm just going to, if you'll allow me, I'll go into a bit of data nerdery here. So if you think about it, you know, around the world, people ask people, do you work at night? But people's definitions of what counts as the nighttime varies hugely, unless you're very, very precise about the hours, right? So in America and also in the UK, we're quite lucky in that we have this detailed data of what are you doing at this specific time at night. Whereas in the EU, we have other surveys where we basically leave it up to people to decide for themselves what counts as the nighttime. And so if you're thinking about that, it's obviously just very difficult to compare across countries when you've got those big differences in the survey questions. So, you know, everything we know suggests that, yes, Americans are more likely to work at these hostile hours. But what we really want is that detailed cross-country comparison. And that's just really, really difficult to get.
When you say hostile hours, I'm just thinking as well about the precision of the points you're making. Because there's many a night that I would be sitting at home, CNBC would be on the TV. I'm keeping an eye on that. But I'm, you know, tapping away there at a couple of other things that I just need to take care of before tomorrow. Like, does that really count as the same as somebody who's working shift work? And also, of course, that work could just as easily be done if I was up at 7:30 in the morning wanting to get ahead of my day. So is there nuance here that we have to be careful of when we are seeking to assess the proliferation of nighttime work?
I think you're totally right. I think that's a really, really important nuance. And it actually gets this really interesting question of you know, why people are working at the nighttime, right? Some people are responding to better pay, right? If you ask people, you know, would you be, you know, are you dissatisfied with your nighttime work? Actually, a lower share than you might expect say so. And really, it's the point that they're being compensated for it, right? Nighttime pay, you know, conditional on everything else, tends to be a bit higher for certain types of workers.
Well, if we delve into that a little bit more, Soumaya, you said earlier, if we would allow you to get into your data nerdery, so if you'll allow me to get into theoretical economics, when we talk about the backward bending supply curve of labour, I remember writing about this a couple of times in the books over the years. And if I simplify this right down, it picks up on a really important point you make there, which is eventually, if you pay me enough, I won't want to work additional or unsociable, or to take your own word, hostile hours any longer. So the more that people earn in developed economies that we've focused on thus far, like the US, like the UK, like here in Ireland, what does the future hold for people's willingness to work at unsociable times?
Yeah, so the really big trend you see in the US in particular is as time has gone on, as American society has gotten richer, working at night has become relatively less common, right? So it looks like people are saying, well, hang on, I don't have to accept these unsociable hours. If you want me to accept them, you're going to have to pay me more. And companies have said, oh, we don't really want to do that. So you know what? We're going to find daytime jobs to keep you busy. And so there's this idea that, you know, as we get richer as a society, we tend to essentially do more work during the day. Now, that's really hard to relate to changes in industries. You might think, oh, you know, as time has gone on, maybe the daytime industries would have grown bigger. that really doesn't seem to be what's happening. The trend looks really broad across different industries, which suggests that it's something about us, something about our willingness to work as we become richer as a society.
And of course, Sumaya, one's willingness to work is also met by one's willingness to demand that work. What I mean by that is we have gotten used to things happening when we want them. Like, I can get into a taxi in Dublin at 11:30 at night or 1:30 in the morning, and as long as someone is there to drive it, that suits me fine. So therefore, I do wonder how the market will respond to this, because as you say, as people end up earning more, they may not necessarily want to provide labour at that time, but yet us as consumers and citizens, we will still want what we're looking for.
Yes. So I think that's really important. I guess this is also influenced by the market, right? If it becomes really, really expensive to get a taxi in the middle of the night, maybe you'll be less likely to do something that would require going out in the middle of the night. You might be more likely to take public transport if getting a taxi is prohibitively expensive, right? So all these things are changing at the same time. Prices are shifting. There is this kind of reaction that we can have to these, economic forces.
When you say that things are changing, what does your data suggest around, say, changes since the pandemic, for example?
Yeah, so since the pandemic, we've seen a greater shift away from nighttime working. And it's not, entirely clear why that's happened. My favorite theory was actually that as companies went remote, they became more comfortable about outsourcing things. And actually, they found out that, we don't need to outsource it to someone who was doing that job at 3 a.m. We can outsource it to someone in a different country. Who maybe could do it during their daytime, right? So that's one theory. I think over the pandemic, one thing that's happened with the increase in remote work, though, is that thing that you mentioned earlier, right? More of us just tapping away at a few extra things late into the night. And that's interesting because, an economist would look at that and say, well, if people are doing that, then that's what they want to do. They've been given extra flexibility, they're using that flexibility, and so they're better off, right? And there's a question there about, actually, sometimes I think about, me personally, would I be better off if I couldn't do that? If I was forced to just keep all my work to those core daytime hours, if I didn't have that opportunity to just let that work splurge over into the evening? So that's a question for all of your listeners. Are we really better off with that extra flexibility? But maybe that's a kind of philosophical question for ourselves.
Well, it is philosophical, but it also brings us full circle, because the scenario you're talking about, it would have been exactly the situation one would have been in if they had a desktop in work and they didn't have a laptop that they would have had at home, or certainly not a smartphone. So it's interesting how productivity increasing devices may indeed lead us back to, as the old adage goes, whether work expands into the time available to fill it. But I want to pick up on another point that you made in the piece about that sense of choice. A quarter of Londoners, you say, choose to work in between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. Now, you did say that that's quite a broad definition of the night, but all the same, a quarter choose. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think this relates to the point that actually evening, nighttime work is relatively well paid. I mean, so that is quite a broad definition of nighttime, right? That will include people who, work in the evening. So maybe they can be home during the day to, take their kids to and from school, be there for after school activities, right? And so I can think of, various jobs, if you're paid enough, that could be really quite compatible with that kind of, a nice work-life balance. There's a sort of separate category of person who really likes working, who likes being awake from, say, midnight to 6 a.m. I don't understand those people.
Neither do I. Neither do I, Sumaya. I really don't.
They exist, and we should respect that. And, that's great.
My aunt worked for 38 years where she did 7 nights on and 7 nights off in a hospital. And to this day, when I meet her, and she's retired now, but she was the most extraordinary woman who could just do that and had enormous physical resilience in order to do that as well. But I have such admiration for people who can do that, or when I see people who are involved in long haul travel, I agree with you. I think we should absolutely respect that. And then, of course, there is choice as well.
Look, yeah, I mean, but also, you know, it's hard, right?
And
it's a huge physical toll. And, you know, I don't want to undermine, you know, the fact that some people are not, you know, who may not have the choice, right? And that's a really tough position to be in. If that is affecting your health, then, you know, that's clearly a you know, not great, right? And so one of the other, ideas in this space is that, you know, as unionization has fallen, maybe the kind of protections for workers in this area have fallen at the same time, right? So that's definitely a danger that we've got to watch out for.
And when we look at that, there's push and pull factors. And I would argue that a push factor, certainly, or the lesser amount of it, would be the decrease in unionization. But then let's also look at the pull factor of AI, because, like, let's say we've built agents in our own business and they'll work anytime. Anytime they're given a task, they're completely obviously time agnostic, because I'm saying they as if they're human anyway. But the point is, are we asking the wrong question here by focusing on the human side of nighttime work? Because are we actually looking at a big transition into work being done from a time agnostic perspective through the lens of technology?
There's probably a lot of service work that can, you know, just be done whenever. And, you know, I think in the future we'll set our AI agents off to work at, you know, 6 p.m. And then the next morning we'll say, well, hey, what have you done? That's great. I think a lot of the work that happens at nighttime, though, is the stuff that's really not very easy to replace with an AI, right? So it's the kind of, you know, the person, you know, receiving unwell people at a hospital, or, you know, the midwife.
The midwife, exactly. I was wondering when she was going to appear again, yeah.
And so, you know, those professions where actually, you know, the hours are quite hostile, and it is sort of to do with our need. I guess I'm slightly skeptical that AI is going to take over those anytime soon. You know, if we can get robots to clean buildings while everyone's at home, then that's great, right? Bring it on, as far as I'm concerned. But I think there'll be a lot of jobs that will be quite lasting at night.
I'd like to finish off with asking you to tell us about the continuity effect, please, as this was a term I hadn't heard about before I read your piece, Soumaya.
Yes. So this is the idea that actually, okay, so stepping back, you know, in international trade, generally distance is terrible, right? So the further away two countries are, the harder it is to do trade with them, right? So we find it pretty challenging to do trade with Australia, much easier to do trade with, say, France. But there's this thing called the continuity effect, where actually sometimes being on a really, really different time zone can be helpful, because you can, you know, finish your day of work here and then pass it on to someone, say, in Australia, who's, you know, operating on the opposite time of day. They can, say, look at a hospital scan overnight, and then get it back to you ready, fresh for the next morning. And so there's this kind of opposing effect where actually, when it comes to international trade and services, sometimes being on a really distant time zone is helpful for international trade. It actually promotes trade, because it allows that handover of work between those, you know, different daytimes.
Well, we've sorted out many problems in the world today between the two of us here. And there's certain ones that we're not going to be able to, like having somebody wake up in Australia and ultimately be a taxi driver in London tonight. But all the same, it has been really interesting to talk to you and just explore how those very practical concepts that we're seeing in our lifestyles interact both with economics, technology, and simply the way the world is changing. Soumaya Keynes of the Financial Times, thanks so much indeed for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, why money laundering is more rampant than ever. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. We all know that consumers around the world are using less and less paper money, myself included. So how do we explain the fact that 70% of Swiss francs in circulation is 1,000 franc notes? Well, the answer actually is a sobering one. Money laundering is alive and well throughout the world, and my next guest's new book brings us into this dark world. So it's great to welcome Oliver Bullough, author of Everybody Loves Our Dollars, to the show. Oliver, ordinarily, when I meet an author like your good self, I say that I really enjoyed their book. I I did in your case, but it was frightening. And I really found it to be a page turner, but almost where I was afraid of what I was going to read as I moved through the next page. And particularly what I found quite striking is that, among many things, that the architecture around money laundering has actually been designed, you say, by the G7, particularly Britain, America and Italy. Will you take us through what your thoughts are on that process?
Yeah, I mean, money laundering is everywhere, and it's, I think, often presented as just a kind of white-collar crime, but it's really an incredibly significant part of the criminal economy. You know, anyone who commits a crime for profit, you know, whether that's theft or fraud or whatever, they're relying on the fact that they can take that money and make it look legitimate by laundering it so that, you know, the authorities, so other people won't notice that they're spending illegally acquired cash. And this, you know, started to come to the attention of initially the Americans, you know, back in the 1960s when, you know, the world started to globalize and it started to become easier for criminals to put their money in banks in Switzerland and the Bahamas and so on. And then, you know, that they realized quite quickly they couldn't solve this on their own and they needed international help. And they turned to the G7. So you end up with the system that we have, which was designed in the late 1980s, really, and hasn't in any meaningful sense been changed since then. It's a very kind of clunky analog system for a digital age. You know, it was essentially designed by the big economies, the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, Italy, and so on, the other members of the G7, and then imposed on the rest of the world. So if in Ireland you're feeling like you didn't get much of a say in how this was designed, that's because you didn't.
Well, when you talk about how it was designed, though, the cost of anti-money laundering compliance, so the cost of what you're describing for companies who need to go along with the systems that have been set up to go against money laundering, you're saying is more than $200 billion. And that is actually $50 billion more than what it would cost to feed everybody, give everybody clean water and sanitation of those who need it. So the cost of actually going against money laundering is $50 billion more than what it would take to basically save many of the people who are at the most obscure or the most real risks in the world. And yet you say it is highly, highly ineffective.
Yes, we are spending this colossal amount of money, you know, $200 billion, as you say, slightly more than that every year. And that's just private companies are spending that. Governments are spending more money on top of that. And the sort of astonishing secret of this is, as far as we can tell, and obviously it's a little bit difficult to do precise estimates of how much money criminals are making. As far as we can tell, this system that has been built up at massive expense over decades is completely failing to rein in the criminals at all. The proportion of the world economy that is of criminal origin appears to be exactly the same now as it was back in the 1990s. So, yeah, there's this very intrusive, extremely expensive system which has been imposed on much of the world without anyone having much of a say on it. And it's completely failing, which is to say that, you know, all of the victims of crime who would hope, I suppose, that their governments would be able to design a good system to protect them from crime are being betrayed on a daily basis.
Now, I'm sure listeners are wondering, so what solution do you have? And I will ask you that in a little while, but I think we need a deeper understanding of the problem before I jump to that. I mistakenly, before reading your book, thought that money laundering was moving cash from one place to another. And you have educated me otherwise, because money laundering isn't just about moving cash, but moving value. So can you explain to us, how does money get transported through used cars and handbags?
Yeah, this is one of the most, I think, difficult bits of how criminals work for ordinary people to understand. I mean, you need to think that criminals are looking at the time, all the time, they want to hang on to their money. And, you know, since there is now a system to check financial transactions in banks and so on, a lot of criminals look at that and think, well, that's a risk they don't want to take. So how are they going to move, you know, money from one side of the world to the other? How can a drugs gang in Dublin pay its supplier in Colombia? And, you know, they could try sending that through the banking system, but there's a strong risk that that money could be caught and confiscated. So, you know, why bother doing it like that at all? You can just buy a load of luxury goods in a boutique and ship them halfway around the world. And then, hey, presto, you've moved value from Ireland to Colombia without having to move money at all. And, you know, this is essentially how, on a very large scale, money launderers function. They will essentially piggyback criminal traffic onto the global shipment of goods, whether that's, you know, used cars from, you know, North to South America, whether that's, you know, earth moving equipment from the UK to Africa, whether that's, you know, anything at all from China to anywhere. You know, there is this colossal movement of value in the form of goods. So we're all looking in the wrong place. You know, we've got this very expensive system looking in banks, and meanwhile, criminals are just operating somewhere else entirely. But I mean, it should be said, you know, cash is still very much a part of this.
Is what you've just described then trade-based money laundering, or TBML, as you call it?
Yes, exactly. Trade-based money laundering is one of the more counterintuitive ways that criminals operate. But really, you know, this is how the Medicis used to bank in the Middle Ages. You know, when they sent, you know, money from Italy to Northern Europe or vice versa, you know, through their network of branches that they had all across, you know, Britain and the Netherlands, Italy, Switzerland, and so on, France in the late Middle Ages, they didn't actually send money. They sent stuff, and they just essentially hid transactions in the paperwork. And so, in a way, we've forgotten our own history when we fail to realize this is what criminals are doing, because, you know, it's a very robust and very efficient, very time-honored way of operating. And, you know, they're really catching us on the hop. We're really, as a society, we're really not noticing this is happening at all.
Yes, but if you then look at who should be tasked with doing so, I found it intriguing that you say we tend to outsource the detection of money laundering to the money launderers, because traditional ways of examining fraud and so on is just not seeing what's happening under their noses. Could you walk us through that? How has the detection of this problem been outsourced to the money launderers, in your view?
Well, I mean, there is a colossal volume of financial and trade transactions that happen all the time. And, you know, when the G7 created what's called the Financial Action Task Force back in the late 1980s to try and standardize world rules against money laundering, you know, they were essentially confronted with the challenge of, you know, if they gave their police agencies access to all the banking records, the police agencies would just be swamped by paperwork. And so they decided, you know, reasonably enough, but as it turned out, unfortunately, that instead of relying on police agencies to decide, you know, what transactions were suspicious and should be investigated, they would ask banks to do that for them. So banks file what are called suspicious activity reports, and they do so by the hundreds of thousands. There are colossal numbers of these things. And so essentially the decision of what is suspicious is made before the report comes to the law enforcement authorities at all, which is to say that, you know, essentially, if it is a clean bank, an honest bank, then it doesn't really have anything to report. If it isn't an honest bank, it's being asked to blow the whistle on itself, on reporting suspicions about its own transactions. And clearly, they're not going to do that. So you have a system that creates a huge amount of paperwork and compliance for the good guys, while not really, in any meaningful sense, restricting the bad guys. And this is, I mean, if there was an original sin in the design of the global supposedly anti-money laundering architecture, this is very much what it is. This fact that we're now relying on law enforcement agencies who are in turn relying on banks, and those banks are essentially incentivized not to report suspicions if they are themselves criminal.
And as you say, we simply keep doing the same things over and over. We, being particularly Western societies, keep doing the same things over and over. More suspicious reports, more blacklists, more financial action task forces, more remit given to them, and yet it kind of leads to the same thing, which is nothing.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, there is progress. It's glacial progress, but there is. I mean, in the European Union, they're creating a sort of common anti-money laundering agency, AMLA, which is very slowly but gradually being created, and maybe that will help sort of standardize rules across the European Union. There is, you know, cooperation to a certain extent between, you know, the various countries, and to help each other out. But I mean, the criminals are galloping ahead of us. I mean, if you look at, we haven't even talked about cryptocurrencies, but if you look at cryptocurrencies and how easy that makes it for criminals to move value from one part of the world to another without any checks at all, you know, that is developing incredibly quickly and very much sort of racing ahead of anyone's efforts to stop it. So, you know, it's a good time to be a criminal if there's a...
But Oliver, like, when I was learning about blockchain originally, and blockchain is the technology that underpins cryptocurrency, blockchain was supposed to be an immutable chain, which means that you couldn't change it. It was going to perhaps eradicate the need for accounting because everything was basically timestamped. Like, blockchain was supposed to make everything far more transparent. And yet, as you say, cryptocurrency has blown anti-money laundering wide open.
Yeah, I mean, blockchain, there were a lot of promises made for blockchain. It's a little bit like AI at the moment, isn't it? In fact, it feels like a lot of the promises that were made for blockchain are now being made for AI. I mean, you know, in some ways, blockchain does help catch criminals. You can see what they're doing. But the problem is you can't tell who they are. And it becomes so quick and easy to move value around the place that essentially the value is gone before anyone has got a hang of it. And you know, what, as it were, sort of what country are these companies even based in? I mean, you know, how do you ask a government for information if essentially the company is just based wherever someone happens to have their laptop that day? You know, so if you look at particularly what are called stablecoins, like one, the most famous one is called Tether, which is just that it's like a digital dollar. Yeah, they are incredibly useful to criminals, whether that is, you know, drugs gangs in South America or fraudsters in Southeast Asia, you know, Russian, you know, state agencies trying to buy components for their drones. And so on, cryptocurrencies are incredibly helpful, but they haven't replaced all the old methods of money laundering, you know, the trade-based money laundering like the Medicis used to do, or the cash, you know, that you think of as the traditional way of money laundering from back in the 1980s. All of that is still happening too. It's just a mixture of everything, which just makes everything more and more complicated and more difficult for anyone to keep a hang on.
I want to particularly focus on cash for a moment, because I'm just going to quote you something that I heard you say. This wasn't in the book, but just something that I heard you say. And it's a really pithy line, but it's also full of emotion the way you say it. So I'm trying to do my best to represent you as you say it. You said, at the same time that major Western economies are creating the cash that is facilitating money laundering on a massive global industrial scale, they are simultaneously making very expensive demands on financial institutions in poor countries that they should be abiding by these regulations, which themselves are flouting and allowing to be flouted. Will you talk us through that? How are Western countries talking out of both sides of their mouth?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that most people listening to this use cash far less in their everyday life than they did, say, a decade ago or 20 years ago. You know, the proportion of transactions using cash is falling all the time. It's being outcompeted by, you know, credit cards, debit cards, Apple Pay, you know, all the electronic methods of payment that we use to buy things online or, you know, to take a bus or whatever. And yeah, it's the so you'd expect that if we're not using cash, then essentially we wouldn't be taking it out of the bank and there would be less and less of it in circulation. But actually the opposite is happening. You know, back in December, the amount of euros in circulation hit an all-time high, about 1.6 trillion euros out there. Dollars are the same, about $2.4 trillion. And even, you know, pounds here in the UK, there are almost 100 billion pounds in circulation, which is, a you know, 6 or 7% more than there was a year ago. I mean, it's going up all the time. And it's a very strange paradox. You know, if we're not asking for all these currency, you know,
who is?
And the answer is, if you look at the denominations of the banknotes that are being printed, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, the most popular US banknote was a dollar bill. But now it's a $100 bill. And the $100 bill is popular for one reason. And it's simply because you can fit an enormous amount of value into a suitcase if you pack it full of $100 bills. So if you're a criminal and you're trying to move money from one place to another, you don't want to pack it full of $20 bills because you'd need five times more suitcases than you do if you use $100 bills. And, you know, still in the EU, you have 100 and 200 euro banknotes. But of course, as you mentioned at the beginning, the leader of the pack here is the Swiss, who are always very skilled at the dark arts when it comes to money. The 1,000 franc banknote, that's, you know, something like 1,200, 1,300 euros worth of banknote in one banknote. And that's 70% of all the Swiss francs are in 1,000 franc banknotes. And what can you do with a 1,000 franc banknote? I mean, it's not like you can buy a coffee with one.
And so I promised everybody listening to our conversation, Oliver, that I would ask you for what the solutions are. And you have two. They're simple ones. I'd love to know what they are.
So the most obvious solution, the thing that I would love to see if I could be, you know, world president for 1 minute, what I would do is I'd clip my fingers and say, we won't have those big banknotes anymore. If we didn't have, you know, 100 euro, 200 euro, 50 pound, 1,000 francs, $100 bills, you know, all of those, then it wouldn't really make any difference to any ordinary person's life. You know, it really wouldn't be a big deal. But for criminals, it would be absolutely huge because it would be so much more difficult for them to move value around. So that would be my one, you know, my wish list for, you know, for just that little 1 minute when I got to be in charge.
Well, for the second one, check out the book. It's an intriguing read, which, as I say, is a page turner, but you kind of only want to read it with one eye because you're wincing with the other one. Thank you so much for joining us here on Taking Stock. Oliver Bullough, author of Everybody Loves Our Dollars.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Now, for my trivia this week, I was telling you earlier on in the show, I was working with a group of female entrepreneurs in a place and I gave you three clues to help you figure out where I was. And here they are. The river that flows through it is the fastest flowing river in Europe. I said it had the second highest amount of coffee shops per capita in Europe, and it was second only to Athens in Greece in that regard. And it has on average two festivals a week. Where was I? Now, I didn't say I was in Ireland, by the way. But if I did, it would have really narrowed it down. I was in Galway and I walked over the River Corrib on my way to my favourite coffee shop in the city while the city itself was getting ready for the St. Patrick's Day Festival. So there you go. That's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And it's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Of course, if you love the show, please do pop it into your WhatsApp groups as well if you know of anybody who'd be interested in tuning into us. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo de Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much indeed for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And already, I look forward to chatting to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culleton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.